thing, if you lost it, could make you lose your will to live? What thing, if you lost it, would make all meaning and significance and hope disappear from your life? Whatever that thing is, the Bible calls it an idol. An idol is anything more fundamental than God to your happiness, meaning in life, or identity. Idolatry is the inordinate desire for anything, even good things, especially good things. And therefore, anything can be an idol, even good things such as career or family or achievement or some good political cause or physical attractiveness or romance or human approval or financial security or anything. So, how do you spot the symptoms of idolatry in your life? Alfred Adler, a very prominent psychologist, said it's very hard to find out what you're really living for just by asking that question. Because then you'll answer, I'm living for my family, or I'm living for God, or I'm living for other people. But Adler says, if you want to know what you're really living for, look at your nightmares. What is your worst nightmare? What thing, if it were absent, might take away your very desire to live? That is your idol. Because anything were removed that would take away your very desire to want to even go on with life, that's your actual deity. That's the real thing that justifies your life, that for you gives your life worth and value. And it may be a good thing, but if it's an ultimate thing and it's not God, it's an idol. So for example, imagine that you were engaged. And if you're engaged, then that relationship will bring great meaning in your life. Of course it will. And then, imagine you broke up. Something happened and you broke up. And of course there'll be tremendous grief, because if it was a good relationship, if it was a good thing, then to lose it will be very hard. But if you made that person an ultimate thing, if the love of that person was the very reason you got up in the morning, was the very reason that you even thought there was anything good about you at all, if you turn a good thing into an ultimate thing and you lose that, it won't just be hard, you will be completely devastated. Romans chapter 1, verse 18 to 25 is the classic New Testament text that explains the nature and the power of idolatry. In that passage, Paul shows that all the breakdowns of life, whether spiritual or psychological or social or cultural, they all come because we've worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 25 puts it like this: it's no use. I love foreign gods, and I must go after them. That's the voice and language of Israel. And Jeremiah uses it to get across the fact that once we've come to believe that something will really make us happy, then we can't help ourselves. We must go after our gods. They completely capture our heart. As Psalm 106 puts it, they worship their idols, which became a snare to them. The language of the prophet Ezekiel is even stronger. This is chapter 6, verse 9. This is what the Sovereign Lord says: I have been grieved by their adulterous hearts, which have turned away from me, and by their eyes, which have lusted after their idols. In psychological terms, an idol is the thing you get your identity from. In theological terms, and this is the way the Bible puts it, an idol is the thing you're turning to for your righteousness. Martin Luther points out that the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, is the first commandment because all the other commandments are based on it. Luther says you never break one of the other commandments unless you first break the first commandment. So, let's take the ninth commandment. Don't lie. Why do you lie? Well, you say, because I'm a sinner. Yes. But why do you lie in this particular instance and not that particular instance? Luther says, you're lying because underneath there is something more important to you than Jesus Christ at that moment. There's human approval, or money, or power, or comfort, or something at stake that is so important to you, you're willing to break the law of God in order to get it. In other words, you lie because there's an idol. There's something else that's your real salvation, something else more important to you than Jesus Christ at that moment. And therefore, Luther says, under every behavioral sin is the sin of idolatry, and under every act of idolatry is a disbelief in the gospel. So at the root of all sin is the failure to take the gospel deep into the furthest reaches of your heart. So the gospel, which is the good news that we're not saved because of what we have done, but by what Jesus has done, the gospel is not an elementary principle that we grasp when we're first saved, and then we go on to more advanced biblical principles. No. We always take the gospel with us when we go on. Because our ongoing disobedience, our failure to change, our lack of spiritual growth is always rooted in our unwillingness and our inability to believe and rejoice in our righteousness in Christ. And you will never change unless you come to find the particular and characteristic ways your heart resists the gospel and continues the self-salvation project through idolatry. Unless you constantly apply the gospel to the roots of your heart so that the idols of your heart are weakened more and more, you will never change. Your life will never change because your heart has not been changed. In his famous sermon, The Expulsive Power of a New Affection, Thomas Chalmers says, no one ever changed a habit just by trying. He says nobody changes fear or racial prejudice just by trying, just by saying, oh, I shouldn't be like that. So Chalmers writes, the heart is so constituted that the only way to dispossess it of an old affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. What you need to drive out an old passion is a new passion, a greater passion. What you need is an overmastering positive passion. For example, in Genesis 29, Jacob is told he has to work for Laban 7 years in order to marry Rachel, Laban's daughter. That's a long time to work for, especially a boss like Laban. But Jacob does it. And you know why? The text says Rachel was so beautiful in his eyes, and he loved her so much that it seemed like no time at all. He had an overmastering positive passion, and so he was able to do the work. 7 years, no problem. Here's another example. Take two guys and put them into two rooms right next to each other. Give them the very same job. Tell both of them you're going to make widgets. A widget is put this on that, put this on that. Very, very tedious. And tell them they're both going to work for 12 months, 1 year, but tell the man in this room he's going to make $10,000 this year. But tell the guy in this room he's going to make $1 billion this year. And I can guarantee you the man in this room will get very bored very fast. But the man in this room will come to work every day with a song in his heart. Why? What's the difference? It's the same job, the same circumstances. But the man in this room has got an overmastering positive passion. He's excited about his future. He's thrilled by what's coming. And as a result, it's not just easy. The work is a joy. In the number of chapters in the New Testament, in Colossians 3, Romans 8, Hebrews 12, often growth and change is seen as the dynamic of two interactive processes. Putting things to death, that's repentance. Setting your mind on things above, that's rejoicing in what we have, in what we are, and what we're going to become in Jesus Christ. And so when your heart falls into fear or falls into anger, and it's because some idol has you by the throat and has gotten the ascendancy, You have to look at Jesus on the spot. You have to look at what He's done. You have to look at what He's done for you and how He willingly died for you, and here's why. Just as Rachel was Jacob's overmastering passion, the passion of his life, Jesus is our Rachel. To the degree that you see Jesus on the cross, losing absolutely everything for you, He will become a beauty to you. He will become so beautiful in your eyes that you will be able to change these things that control you now. They'll lose their power. Do you know how to work on your heart like that? It's only by rejoicing in and resting in what Jesus Christ has done for you that you can replace your idols. And if you really want to change, and if you want to really pound the gospel more deeply into your heart, Jesus Christ must become your overmastering, positive passion.
Because I'm such a basket case, it really hits home. But I think you can really sense the reality of what he's saying, right? It's when the Lord isn't real in real time that we sin in those moments. Alrighty, let's look at some of these questions here. Okay, familiar question. Was there anything from the DVD that was new to you or had an effect on you? Did you hear anything that raised more questions in your mind?
I just thought it was powerful the way you did that, the way you opened up, or just, you know, making you think about the one thing that was taken away. And of course, if we also can go out and we allow so much other stuff.
Harji? I think for us folks, the good things are the more dangerous things. You know, we think of idolatry, we think of the big ticket sins, drinking, whatever, right? And we kind of think, well, you know, that was our past, and some of us anyway, and we're past that now by the grace of God. But I'm sure it's the lawful things that sneak in. They're not as obvious, they're not right in the front of the radar screen. We let them get a little more and more control, and before you know it, they can become pretty powerful. To me, the thing that I get out of this over and over again, I could probably listen to it 100 times, and I remember being taught, preach the gospel to yourself every day, and I did not understand that. But the point is, it's not the once in a great while big slips. I mean, those hurt us, those register. But it's the incremental slips along the way. The moment when we're discussing something with our spouse, there's a disagreement, and all of a sudden, that disagreement, which might just be an issue, becomes magnified so that all we can see is that difference. And all of a sudden we've lost sight of our spouse, who they are, what they mean to us. We've lost sight of God's help in that situation. You know, those instantaneous moments of unbelief are the killers. You know, and then what do we do when we escalate the argument into a big fight? What do we do after we recognize it? We go on our knees. Why? Because we realize it wasn't just between me and her or she and him. It's between me and God, right? But we don't see it in the moment. It's just this person. It's just that boss. It's just this hardship. And it becomes, you know, kind of fills up the screen, and God just recedes into a little corner or disappears for the moment. Thank God for repentance that we go back to Him and He fills the screen again, but too bad that so many times we don't have Him in the picture at the moment. If you really want to change, this is a quote, Jesus Christ must become your overmastering positive passion. When and how have you found this to be true in your experience or in the lives of people you know? So Christ being the overmastering positive passion, when and how have you found this to be true in your experience or in the lives of people you know? So now it's time to be vulnerable and self-disclosing, and you're among family, so you can talk about this.
I think of times when some of the more valuable things in this life are either in jeopardy or taken away, and so it redirects our thoughts as to what the more important things are. That's the time when Christ can appear more valuable, that He should appear more valuable before that time.
Anything else? One of you found, yes.
I just have one example. I've heard you use the term displacement before, which puzzled me, meditate on the thought. For instance, if someone had music and they derive comfort from it in the heart, that Christ could replace that comfort because He's a greater positive passion than displacement.
Real simple? No. No, no, I understand. But a real simple example. Why would I reach for a piece of chocolate in the refrigerator when I can reach for the God of the universe? If you put it in those terms, that's what he means. Now, we would say, well, obviously, I love the Lord way more than chocolate. In the moment, when you're in need, where do you turn? That's the key. I can give two examples from my own life. One is one of my first experiences in a Reformed Christian church, not Roman Catholic Church. I'll never forget an elderly man who was teaching adult Sunday school class similar to this one, weeping out of love for Jesus Christ. Now, I have no idea what he was teaching that day, but I remember very vividly thinking, whatever he has, I don't. And I saw that Christ meant more to him than a lot of other things. That at that time in my life, he didn't mean all that to me, but I knew that man was on the right track. And that's something I need. The other thing is, we've had some pretty big losses as a family, loss of life, loss of other things, material things. And did you ever have it when you face a loss, you're really distressed, you're really perplexed, it does feel like a chunk of you just got taken out of you, and then you just have that realization, but I still have Him. Now, that doesn't replace that, but it can certainly give you an overwhelming sense of peace in the moment, but I still have Him. My treasure is still there, even though I might have lost a piece of myself in the process. Number three, William Temple said, quote, your religion is what you do with your solitude. The question is, when you are alone, what do you tend to think about most? Where do your thoughts go naturally, instinctively, habitually? How does this help identify your idols? Now that may be a little bit more self-disclosing than some of us want to go. You're welcome to jump in if you want. But isn't that a fact? Where your mind goes when it doesn't have to go somewhere. When you're not busy with work or a task. When you're alone, when you have free time, so to speak. Where your mind goes is what you value. So, the question, where do your thoughts go naturally, instinctively, habitually? How does that help identify your idols? Do you want to take a jump into that?
One of the things, and this may not what it's looking for, but
particularly in our church, in mm-hmm. a Reformed church, the drive to run the race, oftentimes we take our eyes off Christ. I just think of that last question that you were talking about, ministry or evangelism or all these things that we set up sometimes as idols because we're thinking, I need to do this instead of what was preached from the pulpit mm. today. Instead of having my eyes fixed on Christ and how glorious He is, I'm sitting there in my at my little desk, just my mind just going crazy, thinking, I'm not doing this fast enough. I'm not going to be at this point. And that is such an idol. Mm-hmm.
Question four, under every behavior, there's a quote, under every behavioral sin is a sin of idolatry, and under every act of idolatry is a disbelief of the gospel. Do you agree? Why or why not? What are the implications for how we really change our hearts and lives? So under every behavioral sin is a sin of idolatry, and under every act of idolatry is a disbelief of the gospel. Your thought on that? First of all, the statement itself, Nathan.
Mm-hmm. If you really believe something was better for you, why would you take something away?
Mm-hmm. You gonna say something?
If you go to, like you're saying, you know, the chocolate bar, it means that you don't trust God to help you in the situation. Mm-hmm. You're going to something.
Mm-hmm. And when you think of it, what is trusting God? Well, it's making the invisible visible. The chocolate bar is visible, it's tangible, it's there, it's accessible. But God isn't visible. He's accessible, He's tangible, but He's not visible. And, you know, unfortunately, we tend to go with the familiar, with the visible. But I think this really gets it. I've chewed on this question a long time, and now it's nice to know that somebody else has been chewing on it. I've often been taught that idolatry is the bottom rung of our heart. You know, that's the dynamic where things are happening. But I've always, no, I didn't always. I recently came to realize there's a rung beneath idolatry. Why is there idolatry? It's because we don't believe God. We don't believe what He says about Himself. We don't believe what He says about what He'll do if we ask and seek. So it's like idolatry happens because we don't recognize Him to be who He says He is. It's a disbelief of God. Now you would say, well, there's idolatry if people don't really know God, don't have His Word, and that's true. But even with the dim light of nature, the fact that there is a Godhead, that He is powerful, there's still a functional idolatry going on. It may not be as clear, it may not be as clear a rejection of the revelation of God, but it is a rejection nonetheless. Otherwise, the heathen would never be judged. So there has to be a rejection of the Godhead at some level, even among the heathen. And really, when we boil down, what is the giving into temptation? It's a believing a lie, right? In that moment. It's embracing something that God says isn't good for us, that we have convinced ourselves it is in the moment.
All right. Jeremiah 2:13 is what the verse might be. For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, but hewed in out cisterns. Broken system that can hold the water. Mm. And it goes back to Romans 1. They worship and serve the creature more than the creator. How much greater is the creator than the creature?
So Michael talked about displacement. Now we're talking about reverse displacement. Right? We've turned from the living to the dead. In his book, Gods That Fail, Vinoth Ramanchanda quote Psalm 115 on idols. Quote, those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. He writes, Note the shattering conclusion. We become like what we worship. Do we? And in what way and how? That's a fascinating thing. We become like what we worship. Can you think of an example or how that functions? If you've ever dealt with someone who is addicted to pornography or that whole realm, you'll find that the other relationships in their lives become objectified, where instead of loving and interacting with other people, they begin to use them too. Just like they use the images of the people they are lusting after, it doesn't just affect lust. It affects all the relationships in their lives. It kind of sterilizes them and takes the color out of them so that people become objects. So you'll find often somebody who's addicted to alcohol, addicted to pornography, whatever they're addicted to, they'll often become angry at other people who are not cooperative with supporting them. There's a reason, because that addiction affects the way we process creation, so that other parts of creation that were supposed to be interacting with in a meaningful way, they lose their meaning. They become objects for my use. So there are connections with sin that we often don't even think about. We think this sin's just off in a corner somewhere. You know, I'm just coveting, you know, I wish I had more, I wish I had better. Well, don't be surprised if you start doing that to people in your life. You wish they were more, you wish they were better. Just think about that a little bit. How it's almost like a spider's web, you pull on the one part and other parts move too. What if, let me throw out an example, see what you would say of this. We become like what we worship. What if we fall in love with money? How would we become like it? And just, you know, the dead part is good, but let's go further than that. How would we become like money if we began to crave it, if it became an idol? So it might take the direction of comfort, right? If I'm craving money, maybe the reason I'm craving it is I think it's going to get me some security. It's going to pad me with some protection so I can be comfortable without too much fear. That's a good one. Could there be another direction that coveting money could actually affect the way we process things, the way we think about things, the way we evaluate things? Just think hard. These are, you know, Nathan? Right. You begin to look at the world through what you value. Right? So if you're really into money, poverty becomes ugly. So for you to have like poor friends, you may not want to associate with them because they're not valuable in terms of what you count as valuable. You may not be satisfied with a car that works but isn't very attractive. Why? Not because of the functionality of cars, but because you're beginning to measure stuff in terms of what you treasure. So, if you're really into beauty, how are you going to evaluate yourself when you get old? all of a sudden you're not beautiful anymore externally. You're going to think less of yourself. Do you see how devastating stuff like that can be? So it may not be like, you may not be able to think of a direct connection between your idol and things, but just think of, if this thing becomes important to me, how is that going to change the way I look at other things? Right? That's a pretty profound, I think we could think far down this road and come up with some pretty interesting things. Did somebody want to say something? Last question. What are some of the concrete ways that Christ the Lord would be King and Lord of our entire lives? What are some practical things to work toward that, to head in that direction rather than other things?
He would be Lord of our life if we respected His word and honored Him in the face of negative peer pressure or loss or lack of financial profit, or serve Him in the face of other things. We have no respect for personal.
Okay, let's take that and go deeper into our hearts. How do we get there? How do we develop that? You're dead on, but let's you know, I know it's warm, we're hungry, it's, you know, you've been through a lot already, but let's really just take another 1 or 2 minutes, get the mind going. How do we get there?
By focusing upon Christ and upon what He is going to be for us, and as you know, getting our focus away from here and getting our focus towards eternity.
Okay.
I think that would, because I think the distraction is quite often, if we get too occupied with things here, you know, bills or whatever, takes the focus off of Christ. And I think if our the importance is to focus on Christ above what it's going to be, and if there our focus lies, then things that happen here are going to become less important, and Christ is going to become more important, because that is where our focus and future will be. And at least I find that for myself. If my eyes fall off of Christ, then things would happen at a more disturbing. You know, when my focus is upon Christ and upon that this world will be passing through, but it is, we're looking forward what Christ is going to be and will be for us, I think, you know, it changes the whole picture, and then the things that happen here are no longer important. I mean, not to say that you're not provided for your family, but, you know, there are issues you can't help yourself, I mean, you can't change. You know, now you get fret, you know, if your focus is not upon Christ, you may fret upon those things.
Let's take off on what you're saying, because I think that's the box we want to be in, just what you described. But now, can you give me some practical, down to earth, how do we foster that? I've got a suggestion. I'll let you go first, but let me just suggest something. How do you foster that? Do you want to see? Yeah, I thought I saw something coming to the surface.
I guess the one thing that we could try to take the initiative is to go to His Word and go to Him and still alive to mercy, because He doesn't give us the appetite, and sometimes He gives us the circumstances that help us. Doesn't give us those, probably, so it's God's mercy, and I think that we should take the initiative as much as we can to go to Him and go to His Word.
Mm-hmm. Good. Any other suggestions? Let me make our lives a little... Go ahead.
Obedience, we need to believe. And one leads to the other.
leads to the other. And they're very well closely related. You can't divorce them one from another. To obey, you have to believe, and to believe, you have to obey.
Let me leave you with one thought. I want to make your lives a lot more complicated than they are now, and I want to make your lives a lot simpler than they are now. I personally think, and I agree with what you're saying, and let me just tie it together in a very concrete way. I think the reason we're not there as much as we need to be is because we haven't done the heavy lifting in our minds of connecting the day-to-day things in our lives, the ordinary things, relationship with people, relationship with our job, where our minds go, where our hearts go when we don't have something we have to do. We don't take the time to actually connect that to the kingdom of God or to God himself. It is, but what I'm trying to say is we can't expect, you know, like I can't help but agree with what you're saying, because not that I want to help it, but it's like what I find is I'm not thinking what does this have to do with God, his kingdom, his glory. It doesn't, like, if I'm going to dig a fence post, okay, I've got tools, I've got a goal. What does that have to do with God? What does that have to do with the kingdom? Maybe we've never given it a thought. Maybe we think it doesn't have to do with it. And if you think of all the many things we do, the very ordinary things we do, sorting mail at the post office, doing another load of laundry, cooking another meal, what does that have to do with anything?
As the Apostle Paul says, everything we do, we need to do to the glory of God. So everything we do needs to reflect God in it.
But what I'm suggesting is, it seems to me we need to be praying, Lord, how? What is the relationship between all of this and you? Now, we can say the generic thing, do all that you do, you know, with all your might, do it to the glory of God. It's easy to say, but if we're not really thinking in those terms, do you realize how whole chunks of our lives kind of go off into this secular bucket? So that our idea of godliness is not really thinking about what I'm doing, thinking about God, and sort of just doing what I'm doing as though it's somehow divorced from him, separate from him. So we've kind of said, well, we're going to be spiritually minded by praying while we're doing all this stuff. I'm suggesting, what does this stuff have to do with him? And I'm not going to stand here and tell you how all these things have to do with God, because then I'd be doing lifting for everybody. But I would suggest somehow we need to realize that there isn't a secular part of our life and a religious part of our life, that actually the everyday tiny little things that we do all the time, they must have relevance to him and to his kingdom. Otherwise they shouldn't exist in a Christian's life. And we know there's certain things we can't get away from. We have to prepare meals, we have to do our wash, we have to put the fence posts in. What does that have to do with God? How can that become a tangible, real connection to the Lord above? So I'll just leave you with that. Isn't that a hard job, right? Think of the tons of stuff we've never given a thought to, that if we did, how totally transformative that might be. Right? But it's a big task because we don't do much of it. But I'm convinced there's got to be a reason he gives us these things to do. And if we really can't find a reason, if we can't find a connection, I wonder if maybe there isn't one. And if it's not something necessary, maybe it's one of those things that really need to be displaced or replaced or something. It would be a bright light.
Would change the attitude and how you put the fence post in too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how many books aren't on Christian bookstore shelves? You know, the spiritual life. And the spiritual life is basically, my mind is out here, and everything else is over here. God didn't put us out here. He put us right here. There's got to be connections. They have to be real connections, not artificial ones. What am I doing with my life, and what does that have to do with God and His glory? There's got to be an answer to that question. We know deep down there does. And nobody's going to come along and tell you that, necessarily. It might be a profitable thing to talk about. Yeah, time is up. Okay. So let's pray, and then we'll eat.